All right, Jen Cooper, the keeper here with the next Women's World Cup edition of the Mix Zone Women's Soccer Podcast, part of the Howler Magazine family of podcasts. Just one quick chat today following the USA-Germany semifinal. I spoke with Charlie Bohm, writer and editor for SoccerWire.com, as well as MLSSoccer.com. Note that this conversation was taped before the Japan-England semifinal. Charlie and I discussed the USA-Germany game, the Americans' potential opponent for the final, and his idea for an NWSL USA All-Star game. So, just two more games to play in the 2015 Women's World Cup. The third place match is Saturday, 3 p.m. Central Time, and the final will be Sunday at 6 p.m. Both games air live on Fox, and the final will also be on Telemundo. If you're anywhere near Houston, join the Houston Dash and Soccer for All to watch the game at the Phoenix on Westheimer. All right, Jen Cooper here, the keeper, with Charlie Bohm, a writer and editor for Soccer Wire, and we're ready to talk about that amazing USA-Germany semifinal that puts USA into the Women's World Cup final for the fourth time in seven tournaments. Charlie, your thoughts about that game?
Well, I mean, if you're going to have your best performance of the tournament and maybe your best performance of the last 3 or 4 years, it's the perfect time to do it, right? We've heard this team kind of assure us and assure themselves that they'll be ready and they'll step up at the big moment, and they certainly did that. So all credit is due in that regard.
Yeah, it was such a different team to watch, you know, with U.S. versus China and U.S. versus Germany than I think what we've seen, you know, since Ellis took over. I mean, it doesn't really make sense to compare to anything with Sormani or Sundaga, but the energy level was so different. And one thing I was really pleased about was that given the performance that we saw against China with those lineup changes, that Jill Ellis seemed willing to continue tweaking the lineup, that she didn't automatically go back to some of the lineups we saw in the group stage that seemed not as effective.
Yeah, and you know, it's I think the main caveat or doubt that observers have now is, you know, how did we get here? It's great to see that she found out the right mix and figured things out and found the right players and trusted them. But we do have to wonder what would have happened without the yellow cards, without some of the injuries, not just at this tournament, but going back a year or so. I think there are some deeper questions about the way teams are built and players are selected and talent is evaluated in this country's system. But, you know, Jill Ellis, I think, is a pragmatist above all else. And she showed that that there's, you know, a refreshing lack of ego and bullheadedness, at least at this point, at the crucial moment when she had to make some big decisions. And I really was pleasantly surprised by that starting 11 last night. And they've vindicated themselves. I think every player in that team proved that she got it right.
Well, and of course, the back four hasn't changed all tournament, and we can, you know, wax positive about them for a long time, because it's so nice to see that consistency. And there's a lot of press about how, you know, Hope Solo now has, I think it's what, over 500 minutes of without allowing a goal. And I always feel like that needs to be extended to the back four in front of the keeper, you know, because she's not having to see a lot of action. The one stat I saw last night was that Germany had no shots on target.
Yeah, you know, I haven't, I'd have to check that, but it sounds right to me, because the saves I remember her making were stuff where she was maybe a little over conservative and got a touch to it instead of, you know, letting it fly wide and that sort of thing. And actually, I thought in a couple of moments, Hope was a little bit jittery, and she's shown a few hiccups in terms of her judgment coming off her line here and there. So she's, you know, she's always gotten done what she needed to get done in this tournament. I do wonder if she's still at that level of just absolute untouchable dominance that she was at, you know, in the last cycle and in the last Olympics. But, you know, that's academic at this point. She's been great, and the understanding is just fantastic. I mean, you have to give a coach credit for finding the right mix, and I think Tom Sormani certainly deserves some credit, because he was the one that really brought Sauerbrunn in and made her the anchor around which the whole thing was built. And that was something that I didn't know if that faith would be kept under Ellis, but she has, and then she's gotten the right partner. That center back goalkeeper understanding is so crucial, and those three really have each other figured out right now, and it makes a big difference.
Well, and I loved the emotion on Julie Johnston's face. I mean, I'm sorry that she had to go through this, but after Sasic missed that penalty, like, Johnston is crying tears of relief that, like, no, I didn't screw it up. I didn't screw it up, because, you know, you can see the passion and intensity that she brings to that and how important this is. And I think it's so easy for us as U.S. soccer fans, when we're used to players with so many caps, and that just seems to be, you know, the thing is that, oh yeah, I've got 80 caps, I've got 120 caps. To have someone who has fewer than 20 caps play at this level, I think we underestimate, you know, what a young player can bring in, especially a player who's already has more than a year of professional soccer under her belt and has captained a team to the under 20 championship. So it's, you know, it has to be said that if it weren't for Christy Rampone's injury, we wouldn't have had Julie Johnston in the center back. I mean, I feel 99% sure that if that injury hadn't happened, we would not see Julie Johnston.
Well, and I am inclined to agree. And what I see in the back four, there was a certain process that took place, you know, in terms of how they wound up together and how they wound up being in this position. And you had a mix of veteran experience. You had competition for open spots. You know, Klingenberg was one of many left back candidates just a few years ago, and it was far from clear who was going to kind of fill that role. It's sort of been a hand grenade that people have jumped on, playing out of position or learning the position late in their careers. And then the center back role, there's been a lot of competition, you know, over the last 4 or 5 years even, and to watch the way you had a mix of again, you know, trusting your veterans and stoking competition both within the team and in terms of NWSL talent evaluation, that's what's gotten this group. And I just wish that there was that same approach could be replicated throughout the field, because I think this team could be even more dominant and more dynamic if you had that same process unfolding in all areas of the field. I mean, there was, I think they sort of got just the right amount of overhaul and an updating in the back line, and look where it's gotten us. And so I think you'll have to see that process replicate itself in the midfield and especially up front for the upcoming cycle in the years ahead, and I hope they get it right the way they did with the back four.
That I think that's one of the main thoughts I had watching last night, especially in the second half, you know, with the subs that had come on. I was like, this is a really good blend, you know. You've got that veteran, you know, and Hope Solo and Carly Lloyd. And then we had our youngest players on the team, both Morgan Bryan and Julie Johnston. And then, of course, Kelly O'Hara coming on as a sub. I was really psyched to see that, considering her performance against China, you know, and that spark that she brought. And so to see her get that goal, you know, that was just such, I think, great vindication for her and all of her hard work. And, you know, and I have never seen Jill Ellis celebrate a goal like that.
Mm-hmm.
That I mean, I almost laugh that it's like, wow, she's got to feel so relieved, you know. And one thing that immediately struck me is, like, that was Kelly O'Hara's first ever goal for the national team. And, you know, here's someone who was, you know, a forward in college and then converted to fullback for the national team with a little bit of midfield here and there. So, you know, what a way to score your first international goal.
Oh, and we, you know, not just a scorer. I mean, as a teenager, she was a goal king. She was a really rampant goal scorer. And kind of, I think, the coaching staff over the length of her national team career probably has some things to account for, because Kelly has had to deal with a lot of maybe unfair situations handed to her, right? I mean, if a coach tells you, you can make the national team, but you have to play a completely different position from the one you've grown up with. Well, of course, any player is going to take that opportunity. But, you know, she was supposed to be the left back of the future, right, when that switch was made.
Right.
But now she's played, what, half a dozen other positions. It seems like she's played almost every spot on the field except center back, I think, as an adult. And it's probably hurt her development a little bit. But she's one of those people that has just taken it on and paid a lot of dues to get where she is today. And so it really is rewarding to see.
And then, of course, the other goal off a Carly Lloyd penalty, the second time in the tournament she's converted a penalty, you know, which is that ice in her veins, which is just so impressive. She talked about how it was a really, really long time between the penalty being called, you know, and getting set up and then actually having to take the penalty, and that she just stared at the ball the entire time. And I'm so relieved, you know. It's like, I don't want to dump on Abby Wambach, but I guess this is more towards Jill Ellis. So it's like, I'm glad that the decision was made that, you know, Carly's taking the penalty kicks, you know, after seeing, you know, Abby miss against Colombia, as she had missed against France in February. I've seen the same thing when I followed the Dynamo. There was this period where they kept letting Brad Davis take the kicks and he kept missing. It's like, okay, someone else needs to take the kicks.
Yeah.
You know? So it's, I'm always a little disappointed when a penalty kick is kind of the deciding, you know, factor in a game. So again, that Kelly O'Hara goal was just, you know, for the fan side of me was like, yeah, there's the goal. You know?
Well, I'm still a bit amazed that was, you know, the second PK of the game, and to have your result hinge effectively on a star German miss a penalty kick. I mean, that's, you know, if you have any kind of context on the global game, men's, women's, and all included, that's shocking. I mean, I'm still in disbelief that happened. You know, especially a great player like Šašić to make that error, you know, not even to put it on target. I will always wonder whether that was just her personal loss of focus, or if Hope Solo's gamesmanship really did put her off her game, or, you know, whatever it was. What an amazing thing to happen. The kind of moments that makes teams feel like they're Destiny's Child, right? And how could you argue?
Right. I mean, the look on Sausage's face was like, how did that just happen? And when you see the replay of that shot from behind her, it looks like she's only like 3 inches off, you know?
Yeah, the ball's width, I would say. Yeah.
Yeah. That it's like, you know, if that goes in, that's that kind of brilliant placement of nobody could touch that there's no way that Hope could have gotten to that, even if she had, you know, gone to the right side. But yeah, just a little too far. And when you saw that, you know, she converted two against France in the quarterfinal, you know, as Sylvia Knight said it in the post-game press conference, it's like, you know, of course I was going to choose her, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's unfortunate. It happens. I mean, just like we were mentioning Abby, it happens even to the best players. What do you think about the calls on that penalty and then the penalty for Lloyd?
Tough situations. You know, Julie Johnson makes maybe her only real error of the tournament at that very moment. I've heard it, you know, blame the turf for the bounce a bit. I think it was just her losing a bit of spatial awareness and maybe being a little bit too conservative not to head that back to her own keeper. I think it's definitely a PK. Pop going to ground as easily as she did with a fairly, you know, it was a conscious but subtle grab on the shoulder by Johnston. You know, Nye had said afterwards that it was a red card according to the laws of the game, and I really can't disagree. I think if you want to talk about dog, that's probably a good example. But you know, these are situations that soccer, maybe unlike any other sport, does leave a certain amount of judgment and subjectivity to the referee and on the spot. And she gave the let off, and then you know, the U.S. sort of drove a truck through that small inch that she gave them with that decision, you know. But I think it's more a question of Germany being punished for their sort of lack of killer instinct, more so than the referee handing them the game. You know, when you look at the run of play, the U.S. I think was the better team, and as a, you know, for Germany, I think they know, and they'll be honest with themselves and say, we, you know, the opportunity came down to, you know, the refs not billing us out, and you can't build your expectations around the referees bailing you out of being over overtaken in the run of play.
Right, and speaking,
and then on the other side, I mean, the other PK, you know, these are situations that modern technology allows us to break down to the millisecond, the contact between Kron and Morgan. I certainly think the contact began on the edge of the box. I would probably say that you know, most referees or almost all referees would look at all that evidence that you can get after the fact and agree that it should have been a free kick right on the line. But in the run of play with a player like that running at top speed, a quick player like Morgan, you know, it's just a really tough call to make on the run. And I don't think she can be blamed too much, especially because, you know, a lot of experience I see is that a lot of referees are going to take what some would say the easy way out is in that moment and actually give the free kick outside the box because they don't want to be at the center of the game and give another penalty kick. So there's some bravery there. In that Romanian referees, I think Alban is her name, that decision there had certain amount of bravery because it would have been like a little bit of a cop-out, a little easier for her to just to give the set piece.
Right. Like I had said before, it always makes me uneasy when it's a penalty deciding the game, which is why having the goal from the run of play following, you know, Carly Lloyd's converted penalty, you know, that I'm like, okay, cool, you can... you know, cancel out the penalties and we still had this goal from the run of play, which, you know, we hadn't been seeing early on in the tournament. So to have that, you know, Julie Johnston to Carly Lloyd goal against China and then Carly Lloyd to Kelly O'Hara goal in this match just, you know, makes me feel really positive going into the final that it's like, okay, if we can continue this, you know, we're potentially unbeatable. Now, of course, we're taping this before the Japan-England semifinal, but, you know, who do you think is going to be the opponent for the U.S. on Sunday?
Yeah, I'm inclined to believe that the favorites, Japan, are going to take this one. England, you know, there's a real value in having that sort of Cinderella label attached to you, which they've had maybe even going back to last round, you know, but they're certainly the bell of this ball, and I don't know that it's going to be enough to overcome the quality that Japan has. If it does, it makes the final even more sort of a lopsided thing, and they'll be able to really luxuriate in their underdog status. Excuse me, but I think you know, Japan's so they're, you know, they've been my favorite team to watch probably this tournament, kind of from a neutral's perspective, because the philosophy. And the system and the devotion to it is so clear and is so sort of lovingly crafted, you know. And I think they make themselves a little bit more upset proof because of their consistency. They know what they're going to do. They have 11 or, you know, 10 field players, in a sense 11 with a keeper, who are all so clean and comfortable on the ball, who are all so aware of movements and patterns of play. I think it's hard to provide enough moments to overcome that over 90 minutes to get a result, you know. So I think England's got a real tough task because I just don't know that they have the 11 bodies that can match that across the field.
Right. It's interesting, the stat that's been put out that I think England has won, the last 3 of 5 against Japan or something like that. And, of course, England was the only team to beat Japan in the 2011 tournament, but of course that was in the group stage, and I feel like a team like Japan, you know, much like the U.S., the group stage is not necessarily the indication of who they are when you get to the later rounds of the tournament.
Yeah, I think there's a, you know, every team at this stage has a great unity and a great spirit, but with Japan, it's just it's so, there's so much cohesion there. And I think if anything, maybe the X factor is they had a, you know, really hot quarterfinal match on scalding turf against Australia, a match where I thought the pace was really noticeably affected by the heat and the conditions. And so, you know, they may be carrying a little bit more mileage or harder miles there on their bodies. But again, when you look at how they play, How many teams in the world can make the ball do the work as effectively as Japan does? You know, it's just they don't have to be faster than you at every spot. They don't have to be, you know, 1v1 superior at every place on the field, because there's the passing shape is so outstanding. There's always people showing to the ball. I mean, it's the one that you that the youth coaches have their players watching, you know, I think more than any team in this tournament. And so I think that machine is still well oiled enough to get them in the final. And then, I mean, the rematch, if it takes place and Japan can hold serve, I mean, what a fantastic championship final to look forward to.
Especially having, you know, that back four in place that we do, because, you know, one of the things that frustrated me watching that 2011 final was just the goals we gave up. We'd go ahead.
Oh, there was chaos. I feel bad for them just thinking about it, because it was just utterly, utterly chaotic at times, you know?
Yeah, it's one of the storylines that kind of gets lost in history, where they're like, oh, you know, we came so close, we lost in the penalty kick shootout. It's like, no, we lost by twice, you know, giving up a goal when we were comfortably ahead, you know. But it's so different. This is such a different, you know, back four. So, you know, yeah, it's going to be, that would be such an amazing rematch. But then, you know, just to throw it out there, if it's us versus England, you know, do we take that opponent lightly because it's England, or, you know, how do you approach that?
Yeah, it's true. And I think that'll be a task, a sort of a new task for Jill Ellis with her team. I think I don't have the records in front of me, but, you know, I think they've been fairly comfortable in their friendlies against England and their matches against England in recent years. You know, that's a team where, you know, there's always been promise, and you can always see, you know, the future for England women's football looks really, really bright. But it was always clear that they were still a step behind, maybe even a full cycle behind the U.S. in terms of what was required to compete at that level, to move from being a sort of a, you know, I think they kind of get dubbed a top 10 program, but there's a real big jump you have to make from top 10 to top 5 in international soccer at the moment. And, you know, never seemed like they were there. And if they're there and they're ready to do that, you know, Ellis is going to have to kind of flush those memories for her team and make things very clear as to how they're going to play and what the danger women are, and, you know, how they specifically go about the game plan, because that's in a sense, it's almost a more sort of treacherous task than playing Japan with the sort of the heavyweight bout feel about it. So I think it's an interesting matchup either way.
Yeah, and I'm just so excited to, you know, to see him in the final again, back to the U.S. That I mean, that pressure that's got to come off the players' shoulders of, you know. And of course, Carly Lloyd's like, we don't want to just get to the final. We want to win the final, of course. But I feel like just getting to the final, mm-hmm. you know, you've put another check on your checklist. You know, like Megan Klingenberg's been tweeting, you know, win the group, check. get to the final, check. You know, and I feel like getting to the final for the benefit of the NWSL, and I know that's not what the players and Jill Ellis are thinking about, but that's what I think about, that, you know, just the visibility of these players is so crucial, you know, mm-hmm. in terms of how it affects the league, you know, going into the future. And, you know, they just made the announcement this week that, you know, some league games and all the league playoff games will be, you know, on either Fox Sports Go or Fox Soccer, or not really Fox Sports One. So it's like, it's good timing. And I hope the wave of interest, you know, we see it every 4 years. I hope it can continue and get invested in the league in the way that I feel like in 2011, it didn't really have the opportunity to, given the struggles that the WPS had, and then, you know, the Borislow lawsuits. And then, so you had that momentum and it didn't have anywhere to go. So, you know, given that NWSL is in, you know, a much more stable place, that it's like, hopefully this momentum can really carry that through. And especially with, you know, the possibilities of, you know, maybe a couple more MLS clubs going, you know, I'd really like to consider this, you know?
Yeah. And I've got a pet idea that I will, if you'll allow me to continue to flog it on your airwaves.
Sure.
I really hope that we could, I would love to see an NWSL selection, an all-star team of non-World Cup NWSL players play the U.S. women, which I think it would be especially great to do it as part of their, what will no doubt be a lengthy and profitable thank you tour, you know, of exhibitions around the country. I would love to see NWSL all-stars get to face off against the women, because I think there's some great exposure you can get to some of these really top players who are working hard for almost no money in NWSL, and are inches away, or perhaps even unjustly denied the opportunity to play in the World Cup, but they're quality, you know, and they're the ones that are creating the environment that creates a World Cup winning team, or at least a World Cup contending team. And I think we need to sort of flog that depth across the board. You know, I don't, there's European folks that would argue with the idea that this is the world's best league. This is certainly a really, really high level league with depth throughout, being run on a shoestring, you know, and unfortunately there's only going to be two venues, it looks like, at least with the regular season televised matches. There's only two venues being showcased. You know, all the Fox games are going to be on are either Portland or Houston games, which is great for you guys down there, and you know, those are great settings. But it's just a little reminder to me when that TV deal came out this week of you know, how much work there is yet to do. And you know, I probably sound cynical here, but as exciting as it is to see the television records and the attendance records and in sort of the interest levels keep spiking, and they you know, every three or four years they're higher than they were the last time, right? The high watermark keeps rising. But my question to all these fans is, well, how interested are you? Are you an Olympic fan that, you know, pays attention to curling every 4 years and gets excited about it for a week and then goes back to your life? Or are you prepared to actually let this team and these players and this sport into your life? As weird as that might come off sounding, it's time to get some of these fans, make some of these fans fanatics, you know? So I think that's the test, and that's the test that falls on everyone's shoulders, the fans, the players, especially the women's national team, and everyone, you know, who cares about this game.
Yeah, and that's always the crucial point, is how do you convert, you know, the casual fan to a regular fan? I feel like the NWSL is in a better position to do that than previous leagues, because with the games on YouTube, you know, you don't need a specific channel or a specific carrier to get them, and you can always go back and watch them later. So one thing I have noticed with existing NWSL fans is they might not be anywhere near a certain club, but because they can watch all the games, you know, and then of course you can engage with your favorite players, you know, on Twitter or Instagram, that they can be connected with the team, you know? So I'm hoping that exposure, that accessibility can make a difference. I'm a little curious about the games on Fox, you know, especially Fox Sports Go. It's like, you know, last year, the games that were on ESPN3, you could never get those later on YouTube, you know? So I'm hoping that whatever they do on Fox, that the league has negotiated something that later the game is put up on YouTube. So you're kind of guaranteeing that access to the fans. And I wasn't surprised to see that, you know, all the games would be at Portland or Houston for the TV deal, because what that tells me is Fox is willing to invest, but not invest too much, because they don't want to have to go somewhere where they have to pay, you know, to get a really good TV setup. I mean, all the fans that watch NWSL know that, you know, the other venues don't have a lot of cameras or don't have the best kind of, you know, production setup. So it's like you said, it's a reminder of where we are, you know, in the overall process. But I love your idea of an all-star game between the national team and non-national team NWSL players. It reminds me very much of the 2002 MLS all-star game, you know, after that great World Cup performance. They had MLS all-stars versus the U.S. national team at RFK. I don't know if you went to that one.
Yeah, I remember that one. I know that was before I'd moved here, but I definitely remember it. I thought that was a great idea, and I think I think there'd be a fun little edge to that game too, because it's not just the Globetrotters versus the Washington Generals. It's a bunch of professionals who want to show their quality. So, and you know, I think NWSL is, and even WPS before, you know, there's little miracles happening every day in that league. Joanna Lohman, a midfielder for the Washington Spirit, is a friend of mine and one of my favorite people really in this game in general, and hanging out with her before and after games and getting to see a little bit of the cross section of what some of those fans do. I mean, there's fans that are driving hours, you know, up and down the Eastern Seaboard. She had some fans who were just, you know, love what she did in terms of the camp and camp work and the nonprofit work in the off season and her personality and her style of play. So they're driving down from Pennsylvania, you know, and even further just to watch her play a league game and then maybe hang out with her afterwards. And these players are so accessible. They're so hardworking. They're so thankful for their opportunities. I thought that, you know, the homestay arrangement is getting a little bit of attention this summer because there's a lot of people that don't realize, you know, most of these players are living in someone else's house, you know, to keep costs down during the season. All these little things that show the dedication and the devotion and the passion of these players. I think there's so many great stories to love there, and you just have to get more eyes on them and get the word out.
And now we're, you know, coming to the end of the phase of the league where you have the amateurs stepping in for the internationals. You know, of course, after the World Cup final is over, all the U.S. players will return to their clubs. So, you know, there's a story ending there that, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, the players, the amateurs who have gotten to come on the field, that they've been able to make a name for themselves. I mean, I do know there's one Houston amateur who just signed a contract with a Norwegian club. So she took advantage of, hey, you know, I had to play for free for these 6 weeks, but now I have a contract that she would not have gotten if she hadn't had that time on the field to show a potential team.
That's fantastic. And that's what it's all about. And it goes all the way up to the national team. You know, I mean, it wasn't that long ago that you know, Becky Sauerbrunn was in just a few steps ahead of a player like that. That, you know, they were having to play for free or play for peanuts to get yourself into that window. The core members, the roster for the women's national team, I mean, they live such a very different life mm-hmm. from the average sort of rank and file NWSLer. You know, and I hope that we can sort of break down that wall a little bit and make that more accessible to, so that that climb can be made from being a standout in the league to being a member of the national team pool. And I think that's another challenge for Ellis, and I think there should be the challenge waiting for all those women's national teamers. When you go home, if you're fortunate and good enough to go home as a world champion, now. Okay, now the distraction is gone. Now you are a Houston Dash player or a FC Casey player full time. Aside from, you know, some money spinning friendlies, now go and show how good you are at that level. Because there's a marked, I think, disparity in commitment levels to the league among the national team players. And not to call anybody out, you know, but of course we know there's some that consider themselves women's national team employees and players first and foremost, and they do the club work because they have to. But my understanding, you know, some of the buzz I've gotten is that the Federation is really keen to sort of turn that page and create that system that they sort of had in mind with the NWSL but hadn't quite executed in terms of, you know, fight like dogs in the league and then let that competition produce the top players that become the national team. You know, it's tough between the collective bargaining agreement and the identity of the team and the veterans who are kind of guaranteed picks for every national team roster. That vision that Sunil Gulati had, I think, has not quite come to pass, but it'd be fascinating and I think very good for the long-term development of both the league and women's soccer here in the U.S. to have that happening. And so I look forward to seeing which of these World Cup stars go back and now make themselves into NWSL stars and really dominate this league and show their quality at that level.
Well, Charlie, thanks so much for all your soccer thoughts today, especially the brilliant idea of the All-Star game. Last question for you. If it's USA-China, what's the score? What's the final score?
Oh, you mean USA-Japan?
Oh, yeah, USA-Japan, yes.
Yeah, I was going to say, we know what USA-China was. No, so USA-Japan, oh, man, I hate making predictions. But I'm going to say, I'm going to go with 2-1 U.S. That would be my pick because I think it's going to be a very evenly matched game. I think there will be a lot of ebb and flow. But the sense of destiny and the desire for, you know, sort of deliverance, let's say,
yeah.
For this group of women's national teamers for the U.S. is just too strong.
And if it's USA-England?
I think again it'll be trickier in a sense, but the talent across the field will win out, and we'll see something like 3-0, 3-1.
Nice. Well, thanks again, and we'll be talking to you soon.
Likewise, and have a great time up there in BC.
right time to wrap it up. If you've been enjoying the Women's World Cup, you should also be watching the NWSL. Most league games air live on the league's YouTube channel and can be watched on demand afterward. Nearly all of the USA team and several players from other Women's World Cup countries play in the league and will be returning to their clubs after the tournament. Even if you don't have an NWSL team in your city, it's easy to follow the action and support your favorite players. Note that Fox Sports will be broadcasting a few of the remaining league games, as well as all of the playoff matches in September, on either Fox Sports Go or Fox Sports One. Don't forget, you can subscribe to this podcast via iTunes. Just search for Howler. You can also access the podcast at howlermagazine.com. Last, if you have any questions about NWSL, USA, or Women's World Cup merchandise, just ask. My real job is running a soccer store, and I'm happy to do what I can to help WOSA fans find or create the merchandise they want. Just email me at jen, at soccerforall.com, and that is the number 4. Thanks for listening, and thanks to PK Ray for making this podcast possible.